This is Dissecting Dragons, a speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers.
Welcome to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers. I'm Madeleine Vaughan.
And I'm Jules Ironside. This week, occult detectives, urban fantasy and mystery.
Before we get started on this episode, Jules, you've just been to see the new Beauty and the Beast.
Yes. Yes, I went to see it yesterday in Dorset with my sister, and a fine time was had by all, well, both of us.
Yeah. Now, I just wanted to ask about it because obviously a few episodes ago, we talked a little bit about musicals, so I kind of wanted to do a bit of a follow-up and just sort of ask what your general opinion of it was.
Overall, I really liked it. I think it was going to be a difficult one to please everyone because the animated feature film was such an iconic movie that in order to live up to everyone's expectations and yet still attract a newer generation and then get the people in between who are bringing their kids along for the first time.
Yeah.
That's quite a difficult, wide audience to market for. So it had enough of the original film that, you know, it was familiar and you were like, yes, I'm getting the story I want, I'm getting the characters I want. But it had, the characters were more fleshed out, it had more bits of story, it tried to fill in a few plot holes with mixed success. So you were getting more of the story. It was very much its own animal as well. So yeah, it was good. I felt that there were some songs in there that were wedged in that didn't really need to be there.
But were they new songs or?
They were new songs. But on the other hand, my sister didn't think that at all. She just thought it was all great. You know, it was more a case of they'd given her more of what she wanted. And then she's not sat there analysing plot like I am, which I can't seem to turn off.
The curse of the writer.
Yes, eventually you will start analysing character motivation and plot in everything. And you know something's really, really epically good, as in, you know, only comes along once a year, because you've managed to stop doing that. You'd have to go back and see it again to do it on purpose.
Brilliant. Okay. I may have to go and check it out because I'm very curious.
It is worth it. Actually, Emma Watson was not the same as Paige O'Hara as Belle, but mm-hmm. she was still a very convincing Belle character.
Yeah.
And I did feel that the relationship between her and the Beast was probably a bit more developed and in some ways a bit more adult, in other ways a little bit more funny and innocent. And also, you've got to go and see it for Le Fou, because Le Fou is just brilliant.
Yes, I've heard some fantastic things about Le Fou.
His character was good.
All in all, like, I've heard some good things about the cast, particularly Gaston and Le Fou.
Yeah. There's some really good on-screen type chemistry as characters there. And you kind of, because Le Fou literally means the fool, doesn't it? And he really is the fool in the animated film, whereas in this, there's more to him than that. He's obviously being stupid, but he's being stupid for a reason. And you feel for him. So, it's definitely worth going to see, in my opinion.
All right. Well, I may have to investigate that. So, moving on to the episode then.
Yes. Title, basically a shout-out to Grey Dog Tales, because I sort of shamelessly stole your title for your quarterly magazine and then, like, tweaked it a bit. Because it fits what we want to talk about. If anyone fancies checking out a really great collection of short stories, it comes out four times a year, quarterly, and is basically called The Occult Detective. And it's an e-zine, and you can, you know, if you want to write for it, if you check out greydogtales.com, they generally put up the submission guidelines you'd need for it. They're closed now for the next 6 months, I think, but they'll be open again later in the year, so keep an eye on it if you're interested. Or go and read it, because generally it has some really good stories in it. And I know this because I've just been doing a little bit of slush pile reading for the magazine.
Fantastic. And is it all urban fantasy, or...?
There's a mixture, because you get some historical in there. You get some that I would actually classify as epic fantasy. There's weird Western-type stuff as well, because the criteria really are there must be a mystery of some kind. There must be some detecting going on. And the main character, or at least someone around the main character, needs to be sort of an occult personage of some kind.
Mm.
And it can be quite subtle, but it can also be quite overt as well. So, yeah, and I really like that dynamic. I've only realised recently how much I like it, and that I've been responding to it for years in all sorts of books.
Mm.
And so I thought, only from doing this slush pile reading have I thought, actually, I really like this thing because I know when it's done right, because I'm going, yeah, this is a great story.
And that kind of really brings us on to sort of the main topic of our episode, because you and I, we're both writing urban fantasy at the moment.
Yeah.
And we noticed a trend in the relationship between detectives and mystery and the urban fantasy genre.
Yeah, there is one really big branch of urban fantasy whereby you have the main character, basically, whether they're an official, like, private investigator or not, or, you know, wizard for hire or whatever. Whatever they're doing, they are having to solve a mystery of some kind. Urban fantasy lends itself really well to having long series of books that, you know, you do have an overreaching arc, but each one's like a self-enclosed, encapsulated episode in a character's life, so you get some character development. But at the same time, people like to mainline them because, you know, and they'll happily read 14, 15, 16 books in a series because they love the character.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, that works really well. And I kind of get that, actually, because if I had 14 books of a character that I really liked, sort of at 80,000 words a pop, that's really only going to keep me busy for about 2.5 weeks. So I'm all for an extended series. What I'm not quite so much for is, like, massive, high-thinking, high-flown, high-magic, epic fantasy that goes on for more than about 3 books, because I tend to get bored, and then people abandon characters and leave them in places for 6 books and then come back to them, and I get very frustrated with that, but that doesn't tend to happen with urban fantasy as much.
Well, I think there's also, there's a serialization quality that comes along with, you know, mystery books.
Yeah.
And that's probably because the centre of all mystery books is the mystery.
Yeah.
So there's more time for character development over a longer series because what you're looking at is you are focusing on the mystery. That is the bit that causes the intrigue and sort of, in some ways, the character is almost secondary to that.
Yeah, I mean, I think it, you do need, as you say, you need a pretty good mystery to sink your teeth into.
Yeah.
But I have found, I'm a bit,
yeah, I mean, you do need good characters as well, don't get me wrong.
You do. I read crime novels as well, and what will keep me reading a crime novel is the fact that the character intrigues me. Because with a crime novel, I will either know within the first 10 pages who did it, or I won't know until the end of the book, and there's no middle ground for me. There's no slow working out. I either know immediately, or I don't know at all till the end of the book. And if it's one of those ones where, unfortunately, I pick it up and think, yeah, so-and-so did it, then you've got to keep me reading by making the character journey through that particular book really interesting. So I've got to care about what happens to the character, even if I don't like them.
Mm. But the other thing is that the way you develop a character in a mystery book is very different to the way you develop a character in an epic fantasy, for instance. And epic fantasy, by sort of definition, is that whole grand journey.
Yeah.
Where the character is not the same person that they were at the beginning. They've made, you know, it's a Bildungsroman. It's they've changed as a person. They've developed quite often, you know, from boyhood to man, etc., etc., etc.
Yeah.
Whereas there is almost this little bit of a sense in a lot of mystery books, there's this kind of reset at the end. And not always. Don't get me wrong, it's not always. But, you know, if you think of Hercule Poirot.
Or Sherlock Holmes.
Or Sherlock Holmes. More often than not, The stories could be reordered because a lot of the stories could be reordered, and it wouldn't matter which order you read them in, because there's this reset. It's almost a tragedy in some ways, in that nothing about the character really changes phenomenally.
Yeah.
Or if they do change, it happens in a very gradual way, which means that it's more equipped for serialization, because you don't get to the end of the book and go, well, actually, I can't get invested in this because the character hasn't changed enough. I mean, very often they have changed a little bit. Their experience has kind of shaped them, but not to the same extent that you get with epic fantasy, which is probably why you can go longer with mysteries and urban fantasy.
Yeah, quite probably. And I don't necessarily like the reset type factor, but I will tolerate a certain amount of it if good stuff keeps coming, as it were.
Yeah.
But yeah, you certainly couldn't get away with that in a great big sort of George R. R. Martin tome of a book, and then, you know, the next book comes along and you've reset it, and like all the characters are where they were in the last book, but they're a complete, you know, the same person as they were in the start of the other book. Yeah, that just doesn't wash. You're going to get impatient with that.
Yeah.
So, agreed. Anyway, you mentioned Harry Dresden just now, so you've read more Harry Dresden than me, so let's talk about Harry Dresden a bit.
Right, so, the Dresden Files. He's basically a PI. That is his persona. The Dresden Files, Jim Butcher, a very long series. I'm currently waiting for the next book, that they get longer and longer every time. So the first book is called Stormfront, and I read it in a day. I was sick, I'd been putting it off, and then I sort of went, oh, okay, I'll read it. And you know, I've mentioned the Dresden Files before. I like it quite a lot. And Harry Dresden as a character is basically a private investigator. He's a private detective, but he's a wizard. But people come to him with problems, and you know, he's got this ad up basically saying no, sort of no parties or anything like that, as in, you know, he's not a magician. He's basically this PI. And people come to him looking for lost pets, or sort of spouses, you know, you think the regular kind of PI sort of thing, but bordering kind of on magical often or not. And he works in conjunction with the police. And he has this friend, Murphy, who's a police detective. And he sort of helps out sometimes on her cases. Whenever there's anything a little bit weird going on, she calls him in. And that's a template that we actually see in quite a lot of urban fantasy, where you have a character who is not law enforcement, but who skitters on the edge of law enforcement. I'm trying to think of another example.
Well, I agree, it's one foot in either camp, really. There's a sort of Indiana Jones quality as well, whereby he starts off as a perfectly normal archaeologist and obviously teaches, etc. And then events conspire that he just becomes this sort of gritty, sweat-drenched adventurer who somehow ends up involved in supernatural happenings as well, and then goes back to being a college professor.
Just goes, well, that's done for the day.
So, I mean, while Indiana Jones isn't in the same sort of, it's exactly the same template-wise in a way, you know, walking along the perimeters of normal personhood, normal work and living, and then, oh, by the way, yeah, we have to stop Kali Ma from rising, kind of thing.
Well, I think in some ways, you know, the Dresden Files and a lot of urban fantasy does follow that Sherlock Holmes kind of template, which is the consultant who's on the edge and therefore can get away with stuff because they're not actually bound by, you know, the law in the same way that the police are. Okay, you know, that's rubbish. In some ways, it feels in some countries it feels like the police are bound less by the law, but you know what I mean.
There's none of that perceived constraint, is there?
No. So, but
So
you do often get it, and actually, funnily enough, you kind of have the gimmicks of that as well. A gimmick of a gimmick, which you get in things like The Mentalist and Psych, which is a gimmick of The Mentalist. And for those who don't know about those shows, they're not speculative fiction. The Mentalist is about a former psychic who, you know, a TV psychic.
He's a cold caller, isn't he?
He's a call reader, he's a mentalist who pretended to be psychic, and got his wife and child killed in the process accidentally by enraging a serial killer. And he then joins the police to try and catch the serial killer. It's a very good series. And yeah, you know, a lot of people kind of are like, are you psychic though? Are you actually psychic? How do you do all this? He's there like, no, psychics don't exist. And he keeps insisting it. But every now and again, kind of little odd things happen, and you know, to other sort of characters. And they kind of always leave it a little bit open to interpretation, probably because they don't want to offend anyone. But you know, Patrick Jane, who's the character, is very, very straight in the way that he believes it, in that there are no such thing as psychics. And then you get Psych, which is a comedy series, which actually often references The Mentalist, in that the main character, Sean Spencer, watches The Mentalist and really loves it. And he is ha has great perception as well. And his great perception means that he often calls in police sort of tip lines and is like, oh well, I'm just watching the interview and this guy clearly did it or that guy clearly did it. He's just really observant, and his dad's a cop. And this ends up with him getting called into the police station because he solved so many crimes that they start to think that he's actually in on it. And they don't believe him when he says that, no, I just, you know, I just observed. So he pretends to be a psychic. to explain it, which is hilarious. And then basically they offer him a job as a kind of consulting psychic. And so a regular person who pretends to be psychic throughout this entire time.
Awesome.
It's very funny. It's a very funny series. And yeah, again, it's that gimmick. And in the all sorts of kind of weird sort of stuff happens. And sort of Sean as a character isn't actually the whole sort of, no, psychics aren't actually real when he's in his downtime. There's a kind of an element where he can almost believe in the supernatural himself. And he's not conned by his own ability, but I think a couple of times he's almost conned by his own ability. And everyone's just there like, you're not actually psychic. He's there like, oh, yeah.
I'm going to have to check that out. That sounds very funny.
I
mean, I saw a couple of seasons of The Mentalist, and we sort of stopped watching it because it became a bit Creature of the Week, which is okay for a couple of episodes, but gets boring quite quickly. But no, I liked it, and the fact he's so insistent, because you got the impression that when he'd been a cold reader before that, that he'd almost believed his own hype that he'd started to, and then something went very badly wrong. So now he has to shut down on even the possibility of it.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that was definitely pretty interesting. And I mean, I've read a couple of Harry Dresden books, but and I just, as I said, I love that dynamic.
Mm-hmm.
I found another series recently called the Immortal Vegas series. And unfortunately, I can't remember the name of the author right now. She's an indie author. But the main character is this sort of gritty, hard-bitten 20-something-year-old girl with a trusty tarot deck, and you get the impression there's something a little bit strange about her, and she appears to be working for the local priesthood.
Okay.
So I haven't read enough to go much more into detail, but I'd say it was definitely worth checking out if you like this sort of stuff. And on a completely different note, there's CJ Archer's Her Majesty's Necromancer series, which is actually urban fantasy and mystery, but it's set in Victorian London. And the main character is a necromancer.
Very interesting. In the area of what urban fantasy actually means, you know.
Yeah, it's a very broad term. So within urban fantasy, you can have psychic romance, apparently. I did a bit of research. you can have urban fantasy occult. You can have urban fantasy ghost, urban fantasy paranormal and supernatural, which apparently aren't the same thing.
So
there's huge, huge areas in urban fantasy. And it doesn't have to be mystery either. Urban fantasy shapeshifters, urban fantasy vampires. Technically, Twilight's urban fantasy.
Well, supernatural is too.
Yeah.
It is urban fantasy. And again, it follows that very similar kind of, well, they're obviously pretending to be policemen quite a lot of the time. And they end up working with police as well, sort of solving crimes, monster crimes, whilst the bigger sort of plot happens. It's a mystery in that sense.
You know, if you can be a professional demon hunter, they're professional demon hunters. Not that they really get paid for it.
No.
But
they
yeah.
just, you know, can't. Well, it's also, you know, I think a classic example of something recently that's come out is Jessica Jones. I could almost class that as an urban fantasy.
Yeah, sorry, I had a disconnect there because I was thinking, but there isn't anything supernatural in that. But yes, you know, you're absolutely right. It is an urban fantasy.
I mean, it can almost be separated a little bit because, you know, you start to sort of cross into the sort of the comic book genre, which is a little bit different because it, you know, it's the superhero genre. You know, does she have powers because of magic, or does she have powers because of science? You know, it kind of crosses the line a little bit, and I guess it depends on how you decide to define fantasy. But as a template, Jessica Jones works very well as an urban fantasy.
Yeah.
Another thing that you tend to get of the urban fantasy is the grit.
Yes.
You have these really gritty characters. And I think possibly one of the reasons I liked Harry Dresden so much is that he's a bit of a nerd.
Yeah.
Especially in the beginning. I mean, there is a little bit of grit there, don't get me wrong. But this is not like the sort of, well, I mean, kind of toward the end, he is starting to get a little bit gritty. And after all he's been through, you can sort of understand why. But even in one of the most recent books, he's learnt parkour. He's had a lot of free time, don't ask. He's learned parkour. And every time he does parkour, he shouts the word parkour every time he jumps something. And at one point they're in this really serious thing and he's literally running and he's shouting parkour. And someone's just there like, I think one is, he goes, what are you doing? Parkour. Yes, one is supposed to do parkour, not proclaim parkour or something like that. And I just think it's a really nice kind of dynamic that you have an urban fantasy character who is not that gritty kind of seen too much thing, or they have seen too much, but their paranoia is kind of played off. There's a fantastic line in the first book of the Dresden Files, which is something like, just because I'm paranoid doesn't mean that an invisible demon isn't about to eat my face. And I think it was that line that made me fall in love with the book. I just thought, yep, I'm with this guy 100%.
Yeah, I mean, the books of the, ignore the True Blood series, but the Sookie Stackhouse mysteries would fall into the same category. I mean, you start off with just vampires being out in society, now people know they're real.
Yeah.
And then all the, obviously, murders begin, as they do, as you would expect. And then all these other creatures come in until you've got shapeshifters and werewolves and, you know, the fae and gods and things like that as well. So, you know, they're a pretty good example. And the books are actually pretty funny. I mean, the series is basically a lot of blood and nastiness and people get naked. And while that's very entertaining, there are times when there isn't an awful lot of plot going on. Yeah, ignore the last couple of books. But before that, they're nice little enclosed episodes of, you know, Sookie Stackhouse working her way through the supernatural world, which is cool.
Interestingly, comparing books to TV series, there was a TV series of the Dresden Files.
Was there?
There was, yeah. But it was very different. And oddly enough, Dresden was played, I think his name is Paul Blackthorne, who, it really made me laugh, because he plays Quentin Lance in Arrow. And he's a policeman in Arrow, which is great because Quentin Lance is like, oh no, we can't have vigilantes, you know, they're evil and stuff like that. And then all I could see was Harry Dresden in the back of my mind blowing something up and laughing maniacally, and I just thought it was a real change of tone. He's a very talented actor, very diverse, and English, I didn't realise, he puts on a great American accent. So the series was a little bit different, whereas Harry wasn't a PI in the series. He actually owned a shop, I believe.
Yeah.
And he spent all of his time trying to convince Murphy that magic wasn't real, I think. Especially to begin with, you know, she was there like, what's this, you know, that. And he pretty much spent the entire time covering it up. Whereas in the books, you know, Harry's very blatant about what he is the entire time. He's not trying to cover it up or anything like that. Whereas in the series, he's kind of like, no, it's none of that. And he's trying to keep a real sort of lowdown about it, which doesn't really work very well in the end, because obviously, you know, it's Harry. So a lot of crazy stuff happens, and it's kind of hard to keep that all under the hat. But it was very interesting because, again, you have that shift, but he was still being called in by the police to assist with the weird and wonderful things, which made even kind of less sense in some ways, because first of all, he spent the entire time going, now none of it's sort of real, I think. I haven't watched it in a while. And second of all, he was a shop owner in this rather than a PI.
Okay, that sort of doesn't sound like the Dresden Files, really.
But, I mean, it was definitely Harry Dresden. You know, there's no doubt about it. Again, one of my favourite scenes of the TV series is at one point he's trying to follow a trail, and he takes Murphy's glasses, her sunglasses, and he sort of pours kind of the stuff onto it, and she goes, what is that? He goes, oh, it's a mixture of ant droppings and stuff like that. And she's like, oh, come on. And he sort of does a spell, and he sort of puts them on, and he can't see anything. He's like, I'm gonna need you to jump start the magic, so I'm gonna need you to slap me. And she's like, I'm not slapping you. And he's like, come on, slap me. And she won't, so he kisses her instead, and then she slaps him. And then he puts the glasses back on again. He's there like, oh, brilliant. And she goes, what do you see? And he goes, oh, just the world, a little darker, and walks on. I'm like, you're such an ass.
Okay, well, talking from our own personal experiences, Because we both write urban fantasy. Obviously, you write epic fantasy as well. I actually write epic fantasy. It's just, it's taking me about 15 years to write it. So that's going on in the background.
It's really epic, Jules. It's so
epic.
It really is.
It's not going to be that epic when it finally arrives, I think. That's the problem. It's almost not going to be worth 15 years. Anyway, ignore that. I've pretty much got what I want to write planned out for the next few years, and almost all of it is urban fantasy in some form. What is it do you think that draws you to urban fantasy?
Well, possibly, I think one of the things that draws us as readers, you know, and me on a personal level, to urban fantasy is the idea that of extra possibility, that this could be real. Because urban fantasy very often works on this premise that the magical is real, it's happening right under our nose, but we're not aware of it.
Yeah.
But that could change at any moment. So Harry Potter, for instance, part of the big success of it was that we could almost believe it was real.
Yeah.
You know,
if we just had the right knowledge to access it.
Yeah, it could be real. I mean, you could comfortably believe that the magical world was actually a real thing that we're just never going to experience because we're muggles, you know, which I'm bitter about. And urban fantasy kind of has that same thing. It plays into this idea, which is that it could be me, and it really could be me, because it's happening in a place which I'm familiar with. I mean, another fantastic example is the Rick Riordan, I think that's his name. His Percy Jackson series.
Yeah,
I loved those books when I was growing up, and you know, he's gone on to write a lot of different things, all again set in sort of modern day, in cities that people know. I mean, not me personally, I'm not American, but you know, cities that people know, and there's this kind of connection. When you're reading something which is fantastical, and it mentions a place that you know, it kind of sends a tingle up your spine. I mean, for example, when I was reading I Am the Silence, you know, I knew a couple of the of places. I knew Dorset, so I'm reading it, and I got so excited because it was so familiar in a lot of ways, you know?
Yeah, weirdly, I think my mum did as well, because she obviously knows the area really well, because they live pretty much just down the road.
Yeah. So, and there's a power to that, and this intrigue, which I think just draws readers in. On another level, it adds a whole new dynamic to fantasy, because the urban part means that you have technology, and the marriage between a world in which there is modern technology and a world in which there is magic is really intriguing.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. And how do you balance those two out? Does one cancel the other one? Do they work side by side? Can you have gadgets that are, you know, like, could you zoop up your iPhone or whatever with some magic and make it contact other dimensions?
Yeah, exactly. You've got sort of the Mortal Instruments, or the, you know, the Shadowhunter series. And again, it's the same thing. Modern day, and you know, they're wearing modern clothes, and characters have got phones and stuff like that. And it's also the, what would immortals, you know, people who've been around since the dawn of time, kind of, how would they adjust to life in this day and age? Yeah. It's fun, you know, you have vampires with iPods, and you know, fairies on computers. It's something which is new, and the thing is, it will always be new, because as technology continues to develop, so will our as writers, so will our way of interpreting fantasy and technology also change.
Yeah, definitely. With me, urban fantasy wise, obviously, I, as you've said, I like the way that you have the supernatural, the paranormal, the magical side by side, almost able to touch the mundane. That's always fascinating. What I discovered about myself a couple of weeks ago, I'm obviously a bit slow in certain areas. I discovered a few weeks ago that I actually like mysteries. I actually like mystery stories. I've been reading them for, well, since I was probably 2 or 3 years old. So, you know,
So, and the first time last week, you suddenly went, "Hold on, I actually kind of enjoy these."
So I hadn't looked at them and thought these are mystery stories, and I thought, because obviously with Unveiled they are mysteries, because if you're writing a ghost story, by default you are writing a mystery story most of the time. And I thought, well, that's just because I wanted to write ghost stories. No, it isn't. It's because I like mystery. And what made me realize is I was planning out this other series and I was thinking, yeah, it's a mystery. These are all mysteries. And it's like, it's because it's urban fantasy. Or is it because I actually really like that? So there we go.
Yeah, and again, it just highlights the link between urban fantasy and mystery, because urban fantasies don't need to be mysteries.
No, they don't.
But the relationship is just, they're so compatible as genres that it kind of just makes sense to have an element of mystery. And even if an element of mystery or quest that doesn't just come quietly, you kind of have to figure things out. There are twists and turns the whole way through, that the relationship between, they just work well together.
Yeah, definitely. Okay, right. Tell us a little bit about Kestrel, and then I will tell you a little bit about a series I'm planning that nobody knows anything about yet, if you like.
It's exciting. What, does nobody, or do I know a little bit about
You don't know anything about it either.
it? Oh gosh, well, I am going to be the first one to hear it now, so there we go. Okay, a little bit about Kestrel Saga. I've mentioned it before. I'm editing the last couple of chapters now, at this very moment. Not at this very, very moment, but today I've gotten on to the second to last chapter, so it's very exciting. It's urban fantasy. It's set in London, which I think I've mentioned before, which is especially strange because I don't live in London and I don't like London. Okay, I know that's a lie. I just get intimidated by London because I get intimidated by cities in general, to be honest. I think actually, as far as cities go, London is pretty neat. And I'm getting a little bit more used to it now. But Kestrel doesn't stay in London. And one thing that I really want to do with her is that I want to have London as the kind of the central hub for her, whereby all the operations come out of London, but she doesn't just stick to London. And that's one thing you get in the Dresden Files, is that he is in Chicago and he stays in Chicago. Whereas I think possibly because England is a smaller place, there's more room for Kestrel to kind of move around. And she isn't just going to stay in England. She is going to sort of cross into different countries as well, I think, at some point, because why not? Kestrel also doesn't stay in the human realm. One thing with her is that she ends up jumping dimensions quite a lot.
I feel her pain. So does Emmeline, actually. To be fair, she understands that.
Well, Kestrel does, yeah, like in the she pretty actually, come to think of it, at least in the first three books, they all end with her having to go to a different world. And I think there's even going to be a joke about it at the end where one of the characters are like, "Oh, you always get to go to the fun places. Why won't you let me go? And then why won't you take me with you?" And she goes, "Okay, next time I'll take you with me." And then the next time they end up in Tartarus or something. They're like, "Ah." And the premise of the story is you have Kestrel McBurney, who is a retired wizard, and she's left the magical community, and she's trying to live a normal life, because she lost her magic. And she's accepted that. She's just kind of sort of trying to get on with her life. But she's also kind of cursed, and that's that every year on her birthday, Providence tries to kill her. And I mean, like, pianos falling from the sky kind of, freak accidents. And on this particular birthday, she gets given this Victorian locket. And that night, she gets attacked by a troll, which is not native to London. As Kestrel notes, as she's running for her life, she's there like, "You shouldn't be here!" And she's fleeing for her life, and she's saved by a knight in shining armor. And that knight reveals himself to be Sir Galahad of the Round Table, and he is the guardian spirit of the locket, which puts Kestrel in a bit of an odd position because she suddenly has this locket that she doesn't really want because it attracts danger, and she's meant to be moving out of the community. So starts this kind of this mystery where Kestrel wants to get rid of the locket, but she can't just throw it out. So she starts tracing back to find out who had the locket beforehand. And in the process of doing so, they end up finding a dead body, and people get kidnapped, and stuff gets stolen. And in general, it just becomes this absolute chaotic mess.
Yeah.
That is the first book, and kind of establishes the relationship between Galahad and Kestrel, and kind of what their future adventures are going to be.
Awesome.
So yeah, you can look out for the Kestrel saga at some point. I've got to name the first book.
It is really, really good.
Right. Spill.
Okay, well, I've got, there's two, obviously. One you know about. It's my my Accidentally Undead series, which is female vampire. She never set out to become a vampire. It was all a big accident. But that wasn't the one I was talking about. It's about a character called, or she thinks she's called, Melanie Beckett. And she's basically an underworld, as in under criminal underworld type person. She's not really bad, but she's not that great with the law. And doesn't take life that seriously. She's a cheater, gambler, a grifter, a con artist, and just really enjoys life like that. And then accidentally gets herself, after a very successful heist, into a card game with an actual demon, and ends up accidentally gambling away her soul.
Oh.
Ends up working for the demon in order to keep herself alive until she can get herself out of this situation. So...
That sounds fantastic.
It's pretty funny. It's too raw to go into too much detail at the moment. Whereas the vampire one's actually pretty funny.
Yeah, no, talk a little bit about the vampire one, because that's also urban.
Yes, it is. I'm not pulling any punches gore-wise. It's not gratuitous, but I'm really not. I can read you a little bit if you like.
Oh gosh, yes. A treat. Story time with Jules.
Okay. Is everyone sitting comfortably? No, you've got your sticky bun. Right, I might cut a few paragraphs out of this because, well, otherwise it'll be too long. The thing you need to remember about the vampire who becomes known as Ruby is she is extremely overweight and is kind of a bit obsessed about the fact that she is.
Okay.
I thought that when I died, all my problems would be over. Given the circumstances of my death, I thought this would be even more the case. Like, I was owed the sort of life, or existence at least, that I'd dreamt of. No more hiding in the metaphorical shadows. I would stand out and shine. Stand out in a good way, I mean, not in a, well, she's a bit too obvious to miss kind of way. In death, I would be magnificent. Funny how nothing in life or death turns out the way you plan. It looked like raw sausage, one of those delicatessen or butcher's shop jobs. Pale and slightly lumpy, and much longer than the store-bought crap they try and pass off as sausage. The sight of it didn't cause an answering tug of hunger from my gut, which was weird. Bangers and mash are among my favourite foods. About 6 bangers and a mountain of cheesy, buttery mash with red onion and gravy. I pictured it, imagining the rich, savoury smell. Still nothing. No hunger. And my stomach felt sort of hollow, actually. So I should have felt hungry. Favourite foods got my mouth watering whether I'd eaten or not. If I'm honest, there wasn't much in the way of food that didn't bring on instant hunger. Maybe it was the strange way I was lying, viewing the sausage from an odd perspective. It was eye level, on the floor with me. My neck was bent at an excruciating angle, my cheek pressed into the sticky carpet. No, not sticky, saturated. This couldn't be my house. I was a slob, but not that much of a slob. So why the hell was I lying on a soaking wet carpet, staring at a sausage? What was that rusty salt smell? Like meat on a warm day. I tried to move and a groan ripped out of my aching throat. Pain like knives, like fire, like hot skewers all over, and I'd barely done more than twitch a finger. A sob caught and bubbled in my throat. I was starting to panic. I could see the sausage out of one eye, but I couldn't see anything at all out of the other. I'd assumed the eye was closed, but there was something warm and sticky stuck to my cheek. Something that hung from my eye socket on a fibrous thread. That's when I started to hyperventilate. I tried to, anyway. All that happened was that smaller and smaller amounts of air whined through my throat. There was a hideous bubbling noise coming from under my chin, through a gaping hole in my throat. I wasn't breathing through my mouth or nose at all.
Oh!
She's still alive! A male voice, even tone, could have been discussing the weather. Not for long. A female voice dismissed me. God, here it comes, the inevitable self-hatred. Huh? A second male voice. Oh, look at her. Seriously, she looks like a Happy Meal. Walking Mackie D's advert. Ugh, junk food. You must have tasted it in her blood. What are you getting upset about, Kira? We need to eat, and voila, mission accomplished. Another female voice, vaguely bored. They all taste the same. Shut up. I'd have nailed you to the earth myself if Mal hadn't wanted you. You're a newbie. No palate. I feel sick just looking at her. Can you imagine living like that? The one called Kira sneered. Probably did her a favour killing her. Digging her grave with a knife and fork, that one. The first male chuckled. I felt a wave of hurt at Mal's words, which was stupid, since I was clearly in much worse trouble than simply having my weight insulted. You're such a goddamn sycophant, Mal, the second female snarled. Why don't you ever stand up for me? You're still alive. Well, live-ish. What do you want from me? Grow a spine, she screeched and lunged. There was a flurry of movement over me, snapping, snarling, and then a scream. The two figures parted in a hot liquid spray that rained on my face and into my mouth. A taste like wine and copper and strawberries. I swallowed reflexively. Everything was going grey at the edges, fading. I caught a flash of a sharp-boned exotic face surrounded by glossy pale hair before the world went black.
Could we stop you there, because Jules, for God's sake! Gosh.
So, yes, as I said, this isn't young adult, by the way.
No, that was gory and fantastic, actually. I really like that. All right, I kind of... Can I... do we have a few minutes?
We do. I was going to ask if you wanted to read a bit of Kestrel as well.
Well, I thought I might as well. So, okay, all right. I'll read you a little bit of the prologue then, shall I?
Yeah.
Being chased by a 12-foot troll down the streets of London isn't usually how I spend my Friday night. Let me just start by saying that. In fact, these days, I can normally boast regular evening of microwave dinners, muted television, and no supernatural sightings. But when you've been Providence's bitch as long as I have, you tend to get used to running with life's little surprises. Which was exactly what I was doing. Running for my life. Tearing between a pair of parked cars, I cut onto the pavement. Despite being barefooted and clad in nothing but pajama bottoms and an old t-shirt, I was keeping an impressive distance between myself and the troll. I skidded past a corner, the heavy locket around my neck swinging up and crashing back into my diaphragm. Sweat poured down my back, my heart practically punching its way out of my chest. I knew I couldn't outrun the troll forever. You may be wondering at this point how I found myself running from a mythical beast through Ealing in the middle of the night. Allow me to assure you that there is a perfectly reasonable explanation. Today is my birthday. Reaching the end of the road, which I tried hard not to see as a devastating metaphor, I sped onto the empty roundabout and sprinted toward the tree line of Haven Green Park. With the gate ahead of me and nothing but open road between us, I made the mistake of looking back. The troll dropped its bulbous grey head and charged at me, and I may have screamed like a six-year-old caught the curb and tripped hard onto my face. No one was there. No one can prove it. I skidded across the tarmac into the mouth of the park, skimming my palms along the ground. The locket around my neck flew off and spun ahead of me. I raised my head in time to see it fly open as it hit the ground, and I realized with a horrified jolt that the park was empty, and I was alone. I lay, too stunned to move as the full gravity of my situation came over me. I was about to die. And not only that, I was about to be eaten by a troll. In Ealing. Yeah, I know. Happy birthday to me.
That sounds like the sort of birthday I'd have.
Now, Jules.
Maybe not the troll, hopefully.
Hopefully not. There's still time. So, yes. Here we go. That's the prologue to the Kestrel saga. And it all goes downhill from there.
Awesome. But you're sending me that soon, right?
I am sending it to you soon. I just need to finish these last two chapters.
Yay!
I'm terrified. I'm terrified. I want you to love it.
I already do. I haven't read it yet. I already do.
I get stupidly... it must be said, I think one of the big things, actually, that urban fantasy in general allows is characters, which... Yes. I think in some ways are kind of more easily lovable than perhaps if you're writing epic fantasy. Perhaps because of their relatable, more relatable.
Yeah, I think that's true. I mean, you can have a snarky, put upon character much more easily. It's more difficult in an epic fantasy because you have to work within the confines of the world.
Yeah, and I mean, you can still definitely have characters who you instantly love in epic fantasy. That's absolutely possible. And in fact, you know, sometimes, you know, there are certain characters, you know, everyone loves the thief character regardless, you know, the character gets introduced, they're a thief, you're like, well, that's me.
Yes.
So, you know, there are definitely characters that you can just immediately be drawn to, but there's something about having urban fantasy. And actually, another reason I really like having urban fantasy is that you can sort of explore things that are a little bit harder to explore in regular fantasy. For instance, I could put this joke in because of lingo. Hang on a second. So I just have to find it, because I'm pleased that there are two little bits in this in Kestrel Saga which I was very pleased about, which I felt like I couldn't have put into the Sons of Thestian, for instance. So one is, Pete eyed my stained t-shirt. Right. Shut up, my washing machine's broken. Right. Shut up, Pete leant in. Kestrel, come on, be straight with me. Sorry, I flicked my hair over my shoulder. No can do. I like titties way too much. Really? He cocked an eyebrow. You're turning this into a bisexual joke? It's our agenda. So that's one joke, which I couldn't have put into the Sons of Thestian.
Not in the same way, no.
No. And the other one, which I was insanely pleased with, actually. In a way that I think actually a lot of people kind of like this, just because of what it symbolises. So I just got to read this little section to get it, okay? What? I asked, glancing down at myself. I was still wearing my underwear. Do you see my scars? Yes, Galahad cleared his throat. I slowly lowered the towel from around me and Galahad turned his gaze to the ceiling. This one's from being attacked by dogs, I said, pointing at the bite scars on my thighs. These are from broken glass. I don't even remember where these came from. I glanced down at my abused body. I was more scar tissue these days than actual skin. Galahad had lowered his eyes back to me, though he seemed to be trying to look at the scars without actually looking at my body. And the scars on your torso? I turned slowly on the spot, pointing them all out. This one, the ones on my back are burns from hot iron, don't ask. Those down there are from getting whipped by a vicious nymph. And these are from the surgery I had after my car accident. What about these? Galahad pointed to the lightning-shaped lines on my hips and pelvis. Oh, those are stretch marks. Ah. I'm sorry, it's just, come on, stretch marks. When do we ever get characters with stretch marks?
I mean, yeah.
Most women have them, some men have them.
Yeah.
Stretch marks. Yeah, so I think in some ways having things like that, it's just easy with urban fantasy.
Yeah, I think it is. It's the tone, isn't it, ultimately?
Yeah, it's the tone, it's the language, it's access to modern amenities as well. A Kestrel, I think, spends the majority of the book drinking tea. In fact, I think it's the only thing she drinks throughout the book. It's just copious amounts of tea. She's a little like you, Jules.
I was going to say, I knew I liked her for a reason.
And it's just that I'm just constantly flicking on the kettle.
Anyway, we better round up because we've come to a natural pause there, but I think we'll have to revisit urban fantasy again.
We will, but before we sort of head off then, I have to ask you, what is your favourite urban fantasy?
Oh, I'm useless when people ask me things like that.
Well, what is one that's had an impact on you?
Weirdly, probably a book called The Splendour Falls by Rosemary Clement Moore, and it's a standalone, which is a bit annoying, although it's, you know, it should be a standalone. And it's a ghost story, and it just marries up this, you know, real different. This girl goes from New York to stay with relatives out in the sticks in Alabama. And there's a whole mystery behind her father's family. And as I said, it's a ghost story. I think that one had a lot of influence on me.
Yeah.
And it does have a moment that genuinely chills me every time I read it. which is a big thing. But series of urban fantasy, obviously I will go back to Harry Dresden. I've just got so many arcs that I've got to read at the moment. I do really like it. And there are others where I almost wouldn't call them urban fantasy because there's elements of actual time travel that's very essential to the plot and things like that in it. So probably something like The Whitby Witches again, but that's something I'd read as a teenager, but really started shaping my worldview in the sense of, oh, we don't have to be in a magical fantasy land for this to happen. This could happen here.
Yeah.
You know, grim Yorkshire.
Yeah, fair enough.
And what about you?
Well, I mean, I am going to have to say that I was obviously hugely influenced by the Dresden Files. And I am going to throw Harry Potter kind of into that sort of...
It kind of is, in a way.
Well. Yeah.
I mean, it's down as sort of children's sorcery, magic and school stories as a library classification, but technically it's urban fantasy as well.
Yeah. So yeah, I will kind of throw that in there as well. So definitely those ones. But I think I definitely also have to probably throw Unveiled in there, particularly when it comes to Iron Silence, because that did actually have a huge impact on me as a reader when I was reading it for the first time. I was really moved emotionally. And as I said, that familiarity of not only the scenes, but some of the scenarios as well, was very hard-hitting in that the whole thing felt real because so much of it was real. So I'm throwing Unveiled into that cookpot.
Oh, thank you. in a way, it's as much as I like writing Unveiled, and I'm totally going to finish it before I really launch into anything else, it will be nice, in a way, writing a character who perhaps doesn't have to deal with that whole forming themselves as a person teenage dynamic.
Yeah.
And being, you know, as snarky as Em is, and as funny as she can be, there is all this angst there as well. So it would be nice to write a character who's a bit different in that respect.
Yeah.
But yeah, and going back to what you're saying about Harry Dresden, I think part of the reason I sort of put it down at book two and thought, well, I'll come back to it when I've caught up on some of my other reading, was that I was reading it thinking, I just want to read Kestrel, because you read bits of it. And I was like, this is good, but what I really want to be reading is that. So, yeah, and she's taken ages as well.
But, sorry, jeez.
You're too slow, write faster.
It's not like I was writing another epic fantasy series or anything.
I don't care.
You can have one or the other. You can't have both.
We demand both.
Tough. And on that note, guys, we'll catch you next week.
Yeah, thanks and goodbye.
Bye.
You've been listening to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast. You can follow our podcast at podbean.com or from iTunes. For more information, visit our Facebook page at www.facebook.com/dissectingreaders or check out our author websites at jaironside.com and madelinevaughan.com. Please note, no dragons were harmed during the making of this podcast.